lot of those folks, because of the safety issues that live on the street, feel somewhat safer out here because they're not in as much competition in the homeless camps.
The Mat-Su Valley sees an uptick in homeless numbers. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, January 29th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, good news for Kuskokwim subsistence fishermen.
The potential for restrictions in the subsistence or any fishery is going to be significantly reduced moving forward in any given year.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Every day, over 4,000 infants and toddlers go to sleep in child care programs across Alaska in unsafe cribs. The Alaska Community Foundation is partnering with THREAD to replace unsafe cribs in licensed child care programs across Alaska with new safe cribs. To help, donate today, and the Alaska Community Foundation will provide a one-to-one match of your donation. To donate, visit alaskacf.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Community Foundation.
Alaska did not receive any money in the Sandy relief bill that cleared the Senate last night. But as APRN's Peter Granitz reports, the bill did include a provision that will allow tribes to apply directly to the federal government for future disaster aid.
A governor needs to request a federal disaster declaration for any issues in a particular state. Senator Mark Begich says that's changing for tribes.
I mean, it basically gives the tribes, in this case, the federal government, who recognizes them as a government, an opportunity to make a direct request.
The relief bill is designed to pay for Hurricane Sandy aid, not set policy. But tucked inside is a major change in protocol. Tribal leaders can now appeal directly to the federal government for a disaster declaration, bypassing the state. Robert Holden is the deputy director of the National Congress on American Indians. He says there's a history of governors ignoring disasters in Indian country, so this is a welcome change. He says not every tribe has the resources to do proper damage assessments and appeal directly to the federal government.
That didn't preclude them from still working with the state and going through the state.
So the current method of having a governor declare an emergency on behalf of a tribe or region can still apply to those who need it. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
The State Board of Fisheries adopted a new management plan for the Kuskokwim River, which includes stronger language supporting the king salmon subsistence fishery. From KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning-Barnes has more.
The new language is more conservative regarding commercial harvests of kings and directs managers to consider harvest trends in the subsistence fishery first. It also establishes a drainage-wide escapement goal for king salmon, something that never existed before. John Linderman is the AYK Regional Supervisor for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
It's a very specific direction that now the Department of Fish and Game is obligated, I think is almost too weak of a word, to ensure that those factors are taken into account and adequately addressed in the way that you manage any of the fisheries, subsistence or commercial, sport for that matter as well.
Overall, there should be less restriction on subsistence fishing. That's due in large part to the state's plan to lower escapement goals. They have compiled the decade of research and found that not as many fish are needed to escape as they once thought. It's what they are calling new knowledge and understanding, and looks at past runs through a new model. It concludes that more salmon spawning doesn't mean larger future runs. It shows that the fry compete for food, and so having less of them actually produce larger runs.
And so the result of that is if you don't need as many fish based on new understanding for escapement, then you have more fish available for harvest, for the subsistence fishery in particular, but any fishery. And the result of that is definitely the potential for restrictions in the subsistence or any fishery is going to be significantly reduced moving forward in any given year.
That has been hard for some stakeholders to swallow. The Association of Village Council Presidents, which represents 56 tribes in the region, has been against lowering the goals. After seeing king salmon runs diminish in other drainages in the state, they're skeptical that the state's new plan will work. AVCP President Myron Nanning.
They're only basing their lowering of biological escapement goals based on one tributary that produces Chinook salmon, but not really taking a look at how the other tributaries are going to be impacted.
At the same time, they don't want more subsistence restrictions. Linderman says the state understands their concerns and that there's been progress made through the fall and winter, bringing people on board to the new research.
We feel very confident in the data that we have and the very, very complex and significant analyses that were conducted making these recommended changes to escapement goals.
If subsistence closures are required to meet goals in the future, there is new language that would allow elders to still fish. It says that kings could be taken by people 60 and older, and that they could receive help fishing by a close family member. The elders' proposal originated with the Nebusqueak tribe, located about 10 miles downriver of Bethel. Stephen Maxey is Nebusqueak's tribal administrator.
Here in Nebusqueak, our elders were suffering when there were subsistence closures at the start of the fishing season last year. They like to eat fresh boiled fish. It's what we grew up with. The elders were suffering more than us young people. We don't want to see our elders suffering of hunger.
Other actions that the Board of Fish took were to adopt new, larger figures for the amounts necessary for subsistence. They also removed the option of using 8-inch gear in the commercial fisheries in the lowest part of the Kuskokwim River. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
Meanwhile, the Department of Fish and Game has just released its long-term research plan to manage and ideally prevent future Chinook salmon disasters like the one Alaska experienced last year. The proposal calls for better estimates of young salmon populations on a number of major rivers, and it puts an emphasis on getting more local knowledge of fish stocks. To come up with the plan, the Fish and Game research team looked at 10 of the state's major Chinook fisheries and studied their returns over the past couple of decades. Since 2007, every single run showed an average decline. Bob Clark, a fishery scientist with the department, says the results were striking.
Until we assembled the data and looked at it, it became really clear that this was very different than the declines we've seen sort of that would be here and there, and parts of the state would be doing well and other parts would not be doing well. This is really a statewide downturn.
In Norton Sound, the average subsistence harvest dropped by a third during the past 5 years, and in Bristol Bay, the commercial take was less than half what it was the decade before. Sport fishermen in Cook Inlet have also seen their catch cut down from about 75,000 fish to fewer than 50,000 in that time period. According to the report, the only fishermen who saw their average take of Chinook salmon increase in recent years were those working on trawlers in the Gulf of Alaska. Clark says a lot of factors, from climate change to bycatch, may have contributed to that decline, and that uncertainty has made the runs challenging to manage.
The best thing we can do is understand as much as we can what causes the downturn to happen so that we can at least get an idea that it's coming. And when it is coming, we can do a better job managing.
Implementing the research plan would cost a little over $10 million a year, with much of that money going to data collection efforts on Alaska's biggest drainages. The governor has already included money for the plan in his budget for the next year, but the legislature still needs to approve the expense. About 1,000 people gathered for the Alaska Marine Science Symposium last week. As KMBA's Jacqueline Estes reports, a survey of fish in the eastern Bering Sea had surprising results.
Dr. Franz Muter of the University of Alaska School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences in Juneau heads a team surveying Arctic ecosystems. He specializes in studies of fish. He says he began his project in 2007 in part to test the hypothesis that warmer waters would promote the growth of the microscopic plants and animals that are the foundation of the food chain, and that would lead to increased productivity of fish, seabirds, and marine mammals.
But then in recent years, with more detailed studies on how the system actually functions, we have found, for example, that walleye pollock, one of the major fisheries in the Bering Sea, do not do very well when it's too warm because their prey base is not adequate for the juveniles. And that was a surprise to most of us.
There's also been speculation about whether some species would move north as water temperatures rise. Muter thinks that's unlikely anytime soon.
It's a big unknown, but the current belief is really that because there's going to be ice every winter in the northern Bering Sea, that the formation of that ice always creates very cold water, a cold pool of water on the shelf that will keep the subarctic species that can't handle those cold temperatures out of that area for the foreseeable future. So we don't expect a wholesale shift in fish distributions into the Arctic, not in the foreseeable future.
Muter and others on the research team have submitted manuscripts on their findings to their funding source, the North Pacific Research Board, and expect to complete their full report this summer. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, legislation that would relax crews' wastewater standards gets a mixed review.
Quite frankly, I think we'll be appalled by the long-term degradation of our marine ecosystem if we allow this to go forward in this form.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
Project Homeless Connect is a one-day, one-stop opportunity for homeless individuals to access state and federal resources aimed at helping them find shelter and services. Anchorage's outreach took place today, but as KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, homelessness is no longer just a big city problem. Smaller communities are facing a need to serve a transient and needy population without the facilities or budget to do so.
What do you got in there, Dave? Well, the goodie bags have got tissue and deodorant and shampoo. And
Dave Rose looks over a floor covered with brightly colored shopping bags. He and a crew of volunteers have just finished filling them with basic toiletries in preparation for Wasilla's Project Homeless Connect at the city's Menard Sports Center on Wednesday.
In the last 3 years, we've gone from 470 total homeless for the Mat-Su Valley to last year, we had a number of 938.
Rose heads the Mat-Su Coalition on Housing and Homelessness, an agency with one goal, to end valley homelessness within 10 years. Wasilla Mayor Vern Ruprecht says homelessness is growing right along with the population of the valley.
And with the issues that go on in Anchorage, a lot of those folks, because of the safety issues that live on the street, feel somewhat safer out here, because they're not in as much competition in the homeless camps as they would be in Anchorage, and then finding themselves victimized. And, you know, there's a lot of woods to camp in and parks and off, you know, park areas off the grid.
Ruprecht says his city has no budget to pay for programs for the homeless, although Wasilla's administration has made it a priority to facilitate a Project Homeless Connect event for the past 3 years. The city lined up the sports center and helped provide transportation to it, but Ruprecht says its success really depends on volunteers.
I mean, we're stretched a little thin as this place burgeons, and we're just not a big enough municipal government to face that entire challenge. So thank goodness for these folks out here. You know, as typical of Alaskans, the volunteers just stepped up to the plate and took over the reins.
Wasilla's homeless problem is shared by many small communities throughout the state. Social needs that were traditionally filled by church outreach organizations are growing beyond local charity capabilities. Scott Chamber chairs the Alaska Coalition on Housing and Homelessness, a statewide umbrella organization that helps all communities working on housing issues.
One of the things that we've noticed recently is we're getting more calls about rural homeless issues. Nome, Bethel. I got a phone call a few months ago from a police department in Hoonah who says we have a number of homeless folks and we're not exactly sure where to begin.
Chambor says the state coalition functions as an educational resource for communities seeking strategies to solve homelessness. One aspect of the fight is the annual point-in-time count taken by shelter and school officials and street outreach surveys every year.
Here in Alaska, homelessness is much more prevalent than I think the public understands. And a lot of local coalitions, Fairbanks, Mat-Su, Juneau, are really taking the time now to to do that street outreach and do that engagement and really confirm the numbers and make sure what is being reported is actually the case.
The count tally is necessary for federal housing and urban development funds under HUD's Continuum of Care program, which requires communities to use a single planning process when applying for federal homeless assistance grants. Chambers says the point-in-time count for last year points to an official statewide homeless count of 1,880 people, and 938 of them live in the Mat-Su area. The Mat-Su Coalition's Dave Rose says his agency is working to expand the definition of homelessness with a three-point program aimed at unaccompanied youth, prisoner reentry, and rapid rehousing for emergency needs. Rose says as awareness increases, reporting of homelessness goes up.
As we've raised community awareness and we've offered more help and assistance, more people have said, well, I do qualify for that and I would like some help.
Much of the press coverage of homelessness has focused on Anchorage, but Chamber, with the statewide coalition, says each community faces unique reasons for homelessness. The point-in-time count, he says, is a first step in a community's toolbox to find out who is homeless and why. Anchorage hosted the first Project Homeless Connect in 2005. This year, Sitka, Wasilla, Kenai, Fairbanks, and Juneau will follow suit. Chambers says small communities will see the problem escalate in the future, so it is necessary now to pursue strategies. But Wasilla Mayor Ruprecht has another view.
You don't detach those folks from your society. You cannot do it. You just have to treat everybody with a certain modicum of respect. As my old grandmother used to say, you know, we'd see panhandlers in the street when I was a kid, and then she would give them a quarter, and it was, this is why you're doing that. She said, you never know when you're going to meet an angel.
Point-in-time counts take place throughout the state this week. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
At least six Fairbanks area Yukon Quest mushers will wear wristbands during this year's Yukon Quest International Sled Dog Race. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, the handmade bracelets are part of a fundraiser to support a man in Massachusetts who is battling cancer.
Will Huggins is a home builder and a carpenter in Mattapoisett, Massachusetts. It's 15 minutes from Cape Cod. In 2008, the 41-year-old was diagnosed with colon cancer. Doctors removed 6 inches of his colon. Afterwards, he had chemotherapy. Then, a year and a half ago, doctors found spots on Huggins' liver,
which caused me to have a pretty major surgery where they removed 75% of my liver and also my gallbladder with about, I don't know, a half a dozen procedures that went along with it.
Today, he estimates he's about 75% back to normal, despite a staggering financial burden brought on by the high cost of healthcare and a lack of insurance. So what does this all have to do with the Yukon Quest? Well, longtime Quest volunteer Ryan Hughes grew up with Huggins.
We were childhood friends. I think far back as, you know, maybe second grade or so.
Hughes lives in Fairbanks. He spends lots of time with local mushers Brent Sass and Mike Ellis. When he heard Will Huggins was sick, he wanted to find out if they could help.
I was home this summer, was able to go to one of the fundraisers and just kind of jumped on board, you know. Friends are important to me.
If you've been to a Quest-related event recently, it's very likely Hughes has asked you to wear a handmade brown and white bracelet. That's how Fairbanks musher Paige Drobny ended up with hers.
I guess it's on an elastic band, and it's their brown beads, and there's letters on them that say, I will. The guy that started this, the family that started into this, his name is Willie Huggins. So it's sort of a play on his name, but also sending a good message out to you. You know, positive thoughts that I will finish the Yukon Quest, or I will do whatever I put my mind to.
The bracelets sell for $10. Proceeds go to help Will Huggins and his family. Some of the money is also paid forward to others who found themselves in similar situations. A group of friends in Massachusetts gets together to make the bracelets, and they fill orders at local businesses and online.
And it's been awesome. I've heard stories about, like, well, you guys, for instance, out in Alaska, and I've heard of some other parts of the country. It's really spread, and it's really an awesome thing. It makes me feel amazing.
Musher and fellow cancer survivor Lance Mackey will also wear an I Will bracelet during this year's Yukon Quest. Via text message, Mackey says he and Will Huggins have a lot in common. Before Ryan Hughes got Interior Alaska's mushers on board, Huggins didn't know anything about sled dogs or the Quest. But the two friends say once Huggins' health is 100%, he'll come north, preferably to watch the start of next year's Yukon Quest in Fairbanks.
I think someday in my near future, I don't know how near, but I'd love to get out to see Ryan and actually give it a go.
Will Huggins says he'll follow along as 26 teams make their way down the Yukon Quest Trail between Whitehorse and Fairbanks this year. The race starts Saturday. I'm Emily Schwing in Fairbanks.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you are an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an Individual Artist Award. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
A bill that would relax the wastewater standards placed on cruise ships by Alaska voters is on the fast track in the Senate. The Senate Resources Committee took the first public testimony on Bill 29 last Friday. Proponents of the bill advocated for the lower standards, saying that the current law unfairly puts ships under tighter rules than Alaskan communities. The leading opponent of the bill was a marine ecologist who was dissenting from her colleagues on the Science Advisory Panel that studies cruise ship wastewater. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Governor Parnell is putting his weight behind SB 29 to expedite permitting for cruise lines by this summer. Carla Hart with Alaska Community Action on Toxics urged the Senate Resources Committee to slow down.
The risk of quick action in your part is that you'll betray the voters of Alaska who voted to have this higher standard of clean water.
Hart reminded the committee that the amount of discharge was significant. More people visit Alaska on cruise ships each summer than live in the state. She did not think leveling cruise ship discharge with local communities made sense.
If an Alaska community doesn't meet discharge standards, it's in our front yard. We know where it comes from, we know where it is, and we know who's responsible, and we have to clean it up. Ships discharge anywhere, so remote areas that you might go to for subsistence harvest or for commercial fishing or whatever that you might think are clean because they're far away from any apparent discharge could actually be getting a pretty substantial burden over time and over all of the ships that are going on, because a lot of these things are heavier metals that bioaccumulate.
Alaska voters in 2006 passed the statewide cruise ship initiative, which set wastewater standards at the point of discharge. The Department of Environmental Conservation subsequently granted cruise lines temporary relief from these requirements to allow them time to install the necessary treatment systems. Putting ships on a different standard than Alaskan communities was a major argument against the initiative. John Kimmel with Cruise Line Agencies of Alaska told the committee that Senate Bill 29 would correct a flaw in the law that the voters adopted.
The cruise ships really need to be held to the same standard as everybody else. The original initiative held them to a higher standard than everyone else, and we're just trying to make it, this fix is going to make it more fair for the cruise lines.
A variation of this theme has made it to the table from a different direction. The Alaska Cruise Ship Wastewater Science Advisory Panel, in a preliminary report, says that many ships now meet or exceed Alaska water standards except for a few key heavy metals like copper. The report concludes that there would be little, if any, environmental benefit to requiring cruise ships to adopt additional treatment methods in the future. The report gave advocates of the cruise industry an opening to talk about science. This is Andy Rogers, the deputy director of the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce. He testified that his organization has now adopted a position
advocating for legislation and regulations that are based on sound science as opposed to a precautionary method.
And this is Bob Janes, a tour operator from Juneau.
I am not a scientist, and I think this subject is all about science.
But at least one bona fide scientist who testified before the Senate Resources Committee disagreed with the conclusions of the Science Advisory Panel, which she herself sits on. Michelle Ridgway, a marine ecologist in Juneau, believes the other members of the panel underestimate the potential harm from the consistent discharge of heavy metals.
Quite frankly, I think we'll be appalled by the long-term degradation of our marine ecosystem if we allow this to go forward in this form.
Ridgway thinks applying rules for shore-based treatment plants, which allow for mixing zones to cruise ships, will ultimately create a kind of Sophie's choice for the state.
I believe it will be exceedingly, excruciatingly difficult for Alaskans to concur on where it is within a 0 to 3 nautical mile area, our state waters, that we find it's acceptable for vessels to discharge water that contains copper, zinc, nickel, and ammonia at levels that are known to be acutely and chronically toxic to marine life that we all depend upon.
Chip Toma, president of Responsible Cruising in Alaska, said it was his organization's preference that ships discharge all waste in federal waters. He urged the committee to maintain the water quality standards set by voters, saying it was likely that much of the copper contamination would eventually be reduced as ships modernized with the use of flexible plastic plumbing. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Princess Cruise Lines has agreed to pay $20,000 in fines for dumping water from onboard swimming pools into Glacier Bay National Park and Preserve in 2011. The fine was announced by the Environmental Protection Agency today. The EPA writes that Princess violated the Clean Water Act in May 2011 when more than 66,000 gallons of pool water was discharged into the waters of Glacier Bay National Park. EPA writes there was a software malfunction on the ship, the Golden Princess, causing the pool valves to open and allow chlorinated water from 6 of the ship's pools and spas to dump into Glacier Bay. Princess notified EPA of the discharges by phone the next day. The EPA said the incident violated the wastewater discharge permit for large cruise ships, which prohibits the discharge of pool or spa water in national parks and refuges. The Federal Clean Water Act allows the EPA to fine cruise companies for permit violations. The Golden Princess can host more than 500 passengers and sails in Alaska during the summer season. It sails to Hawaii, the South Pacific, and South America at other times of the year. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Jacqueline Estes and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Margaret Friedenauer in Haines. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Grant Station, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com. The 2013 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com. And by
the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, where every year Alaska Natives from all corners of the state graduate and become engineers, scientists, and physicians. What started as an idea in 1995 is now 1,000 strong. Learn more at ansep.net. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.